Good morning, CHD. Welcome to Pediatric Perspectives. This is where we are looking at children's health challenges from a different perspective, one that includes critical thinking, one that's not afraid to give you the honest truth. And today we're going to cover stories that have been in the news this year. And my guest today is Dr. Liz Mumper. Welcome, Dr. Mumper, to the show.
Thank you, Paul. I'm so glad to be here.
I imagine there are many in the audience that just don't know what an amazing gift it is to have you on this show. You are, in my opinion, the pediatrician's pediatrician. Like, if I had to pick somebody, you'd be my pediatrician. When I was opening up my mind to what the heck's going on with our world and health, I attended conferences where you were up there speaking. You've been speaking and teaching for over 20 years, maybe longer than that.
Yeah, I kind of got you in a little bit of trouble along the way, which can happen when those of us who are brave enough to face the truth and speak truth to power do that. But I think you'll agree, we've had really intriguing, interesting careers, and it's been wonderful to be able to help a lot of kids along the way.
Yeah. And for people who don't know, Dr. Mumper has an incredible heart for kids who are really struggling. You've worked, and I think you opened the Remlin Center, did you not?
I did, yeah. 2007.
That was right when I was waking up and leaving my old practice to start my own, where I could do things with informed consent and honoring parents' wishes. But you've been doing that a long time, taking care of the toughest kids, mostly autism, right?
Yeah, a lot of kids with autism, but I also had a general peds practice. And one of the things I really wanted to do was to take what I learned from the parents of the kids with the really sick, complicated problems who had autism and try to prevent autism in my practice. So you and I both had that hope. And by doing things like, you know, really working on the kids' microbiome and helping them not have too many antibiotics and modifying the number of vaccines they got at any given time, you know, you and I both have had an impact on our numbers not showing as much autism as in the general population. And I hope that kind of work goes forward as you and I age.
I read your article where you published some of your data from your study, and you had, I think it was no autism in your unvaxxed kids, if I recall correctly.
That was right. And then because the universe has a really perverse sense of humor, as that paper was in press, I got my first child. So my number turned out to be 1 in 297 for kids with autism.
Gotcha.
That child did have a strong family history that put him at risk. But yeah, I was on a streak there until I decided to write it up.
That's what you get for writing it up. And folks, that's just a fact of what happens to children sometimes. Harm can develop over time, right? And we'll get to this. But before we could talk the whole show about this, but I want to get into some of the news. So there was an article. Folks, if you are not reading The Defender, go to childrenshealthdefense.org, click on that first link to The Defender. You can search information about anything and almost guarantee you it's been written about and written well. There was an article that caught my attention. It was January 29th. Scientists call for a global moratorium on mRNA vaccines, immediate removal from the childhood schedule. And they listed reasons as the fact that these are reclassified gene therapies, there's poor efficacy, significant adverse events, including death, and very little testing about this technology and what the long-term implications might be. I was horrified to see the CDC go ahead and add this shot to the childhood schedule. What are your thoughts about this?
Well, I applaud the scientists that wrote this paper calling for the moratorium, because I have spent the last year researching COVID vaccines in kids, and I'm writing a book that should come out this summer about it. And the more I learned, the more worried I became. First of all, I hate the idea that a product that basically is giving these children cells the instructions to make spike protein, and there's no real off switch. So we don't know how many kids are going to make too much spike protein and get a lot of toxicity from that. We don't know how many kids aren't going to make enough and it's not going to do them any good. But furthermore, it only lasts for a few months and the side effects are devastating, many, many times more than anything we've seen with any other vaccine. horrific neurologic side effects, which is particularly horrible for me since I spent my career trying to help the kids that have neurologic problems. But now we're seeing children with stroke-like events, which didn't used to happen. I get worried about myocarditis, which can kind of fly under the radar because for many years, when a child presented with chest pain, we were told and found that it was usually either gastrointestinal or musculoskeletal. So not every pediatrician or family doc would think about it. But when we actually look for it prospectively in kids that get the shot, there's a shocking risk of heart damage that doesn't really go away. I'm very worried about potential reproductive toxicity. You know, our babies who are born, our little girls have all the eggs they'll ever have in their ovaries. And we know that these vaccines preferentially go to the ovaries. So I'm worried about impacts on fertility. And we also know that these shots can disable something called P53, which I think of as the guardian to the genome. It's one of the parts of our immune system that surveils our body for cancer cells and tries to destroy them early on. So I think all these long-term risks are far, far, far too great for any kind of 3 or 4 month protection. Yeah. And that's not even considering the fact that most kids who get COVID do great with it. So yeah. I'm thinking that you have some thoughts along those lines too.
Well, you summarized it beautifully. And the thing is, you're spot on. Kids don't, healthy children don't die from COVID. It's a minor cold. At the most, they may get a bit of a cough. I had not a single patient in my busy practice before I retired, you know, over 10,000 active patients. Not one ended up in the hospital with COVID, except a kid who got the shot on their own, went to a pharmacy. They were old enough. Once they rolled that out, ended up hospitalized for myocarditis. It was the first case of myocarditis I had had. And I wasn't even giving these shots. It was only a few kids that would go seek them on their own. Folks, you've got it right there. I think that's a strong, protect your kids, parents, right? We're giving you the truth. We're not afraid to speak it. This is all harm, pretty much, and almost zero benefit. So
I agree.
Yeah. All right. Let's move on to another one. This one, I just want to get your perspective quick. There have been several articles in the Defender about fluoride. I guess there's this large landmark fluoride trial going on. Now, when I came out of medical school, it was already just a thing you did. You know, that we were taught in pediatrics, one of the most important things we can do for the health of our children's teeth is to make sure they have fluoride in their water. And if not, to actually give them fluoride supplements. And I remember being reprimanded at one point when I was in training because something instinctively in me seemed to prevent me from recommending that. I didn't know what I know today, but I just kept forgetting to recommend it and I would be reprimanded. What's your experience with fluoride and what are your thoughts about this?
Well, I too came out of training thinking that it was something I should do. So we used to give drops to the infants and then there was a little chewable orange flavored tablet we would give to the older toddlers. But one of the advantages of having my own practice for many years is that I quit giving fluoride because I read the history of it. And fluoride in our water, weirdly enough, grew out of leftover chemicals from the experiments that were done in World War II, looking for essentially biological warfare. So I started seeing the data about how many, so many teenagers who got fluoride supplementation ended up with mottled teeth called fluorosis due to extra fluoride. And then I was also concerned about the potential interactions of the fluoride molecule with certain medications and chemical messages in children's bodies. So I have not been routinely recommending it for probably a couple of decades now.
Wow. Good for you. Yeah. Grand Gene published an article that showed it's an actual neurotoxin. So because our world is so full of toxins in general, it just makes sense as a parent to do whatever you can to reduce toxicity for your kids, because toxins are not 1 + 1 = 2. Sometimes it's magnitudes more toxicity when you combine toxins. So here's an article recently written about Tylenol in pregnancy. I know we've, you know, shared conferences where Tylenol is discussed, but this was Tylenol use during pregnancy linked to delayed language development. And the article goes on to point out that there's even concerns that Tylenol during pregnancy can lead to increased autism and neurological issues. What do you think?
So I agree that we should be counseling our pregnant women not to take acetaminophen in pregnancy. One of the things about acetaminophen is that it depletes something called glutathione. And glutathione is the major intracellular antioxidant in our body. It's also the gateway to detoxification. And it works along the same pathway that some of our kids have trouble with when they have autism. So I think that depleting glutathione is not a good thing in pregnancy. It's good. Glutathione itself is good for the mitochondria, which produce energy, good for the immune system, and good for the gut lining. So all those things are important aspects of health that we want to preserve. And by giving acetaminophen, you can deplete that important ingredient. Also, fevers and pain in pregnant women can be treated other ways. One of my favorite ways is to take a tepid bath where you get in water that's not too hot, but it's not totally cold because you don't want to shiver. And that can bring a fever down. And then other things like massage and heat can help with pain. So let's look for other alternatives instead of immediately turning to acetaminophen.
Yeah, I think, folks, you should just get it out of your house. Absolutely, it shouldn't be. It is so harmful in that, as you described what it does to glutathione, you're actually amplifying the toxicity of other things because you can't detox properly. And, you know, mitochondrial function is your energy. Every cell has hundreds, if not thousands, of mitochondria, and they're churning out energy every, well, split second, every hundredth of a second, something like that. It's amazing. You don't want to block that. You just, yeah, we just don't want, that's your life force. And so I couldn't agree more. I'm curious what you think about, I'm just going to close with a couple other topics that are just always circling in the news. And one is measles. It seems to me every so often we've got a news blast of there's an uptick in measles or something like that. And of course, following that announcement would be, you know, make sure you've updated your boosters and your kids are vaccinated. What are your thoughts? Do you get nervous for your patient population? Since you and I both had, well, you still have, I'm retired, practices with a significant number of unvaxxed kids, would you be worried about their health when measles hits the news?
Honestly, Paul, I'm not. For one thing, when they quote those horrific numbers about the death rates in measles, they're typically talking about third world countries where you don't have access to clean water and you don't have good sewage options. In the United States, a death from measles would be vanishingly rare. But the big problem with the whole discussion is that the measles vaccine is not foolproof by any means. And if you look in very highly vaccinated populations, for example, when you look at college students where measles, mumps, or rubella is required for their entry into university, they end up having these cyclic measles outbreaks about every 3 or 4 years. So the vaccine is not a cure-all the way that it is sometimes presented. And you may remember that the reason I changed my whole career and left an academic position teaching residents, which I love, is that I gave a 15-month-old young Black infant an MMR vaccine back in the late 90s and then watched in horror as he regressed. Mm-hmm. And even though all the politically correct news out of mainstream will tell you that there's no epidemiologic correlation between MMR vaccine and autism, you and I have both seen individual patients where that definitely was one of the environmental triggers. I am not saying it is the only one, but we know that the uptick in autism has to be environmental because genes don't change this much in the period of 2 decades. So I worry about the vaccine. I typically, when parents request it, give it either at 2 years of age for white kids and at 3 years of age for Black kids, because we know from some CDC data that children who are African American and descent tend to have a higher risk of developing autism if they get MMR vaccine really early. Measles, the disease, is 5 days of fever and spots, And it comes with the bonus of lifetime immunity, which you do not get with these shots, which have waning immunity.
Right. Yeah, we share the same history as pediatricians who listen to our patients, who allowed informed consent, and thus we would allow parents. Typically, I know you've had this story multiple times. We've talked about it. If a family has one child with autism and they watch their child regress after an MMR or a series of shots, they don't want to vaccinate again. They don't want to take a chance on having that same thing happen to their next. Our peers kick them out, so they find us. And we get to hear these stories. I've listened to hundreds, I'm sure you have too, of, you know, weeping parents about how their kid was perfectly fine, making great eye contact, sometimes starting to speak. They get a shot or a series of shots and boom, they lose their kid in the sense that they lose eye contact, they lose speech. And many of these children are lifelong significantly impaired. And it's tragic, right?
I agree. It's really hard to listen to those stories. But I think that if people like you and me sat on the committees that made decisions about vaccine administration, the same decisions would not be made. The academic people that tend to sit on the committees are looking at charts and looking at epidemiologic data that is fundamentally flawed and don't have the opportunity to hear the same story over and over again, which has certainly impacted your career and my career in very profound ways.
I just heard a calling there. I think where there's something we're supposed to do, and let's figure it out and do it. Let's figure out what committees we're going to be able to get onto, if they'll even let us. So your take then, while we're touching on autism, because that's affected, you know, I sort of see that as the canary in the coal mine. I mean, these are our most affected kids. Pediatricians are supposed to know what to do for children. I mean, that's our specialty. And yet we don't get much training on even what's causing autism, right? Everybody's throwing their hands up still. Oh, we don't know. Can you touch on that a little bit? Because I know the parents who are listening, you know, you don't want a cancer diagnosis, but you don't want an autism diagnosis either. Those are kind of the things that as a parent, you'll do anything to make sure you save your child from that kind of pain and distress. You just had a grandbaby. I know you're traveled to the Northwest to see your new grandbaby. If you had the ability to share with your grandbaby's parents, here are the most important things I think you should do to sort of protect your child from the risk of becoming autistic or you know, developing chronic anything. What would your advice be?
So little baby Tessa is only 2 days old, not even quite that as we speak. And one thing that I was delighted about is that my daughter and her husband decided not to do the hepatitis B vaccine at birth. Since she's a girl, she has a lower risk of autism than boys. But we know from some very good studies in South America that hepatitis B vaccine in infant males is associated with the higher risk of autism. So that's one thing. Another thing I really like is strongly promoting breastfeeding. Because there's a lot of immunologic information in the breast milk that formula tries to mimic but can never do as good a job on. So I strongly promote breastfeeding because the lactobacillus and the bifidobacteria in the breast milk have helped set up a very healthy microbiome. And it's very important to me to use the first 1,000 days of life to help the baby develop good gut flora. These are the germs in our guts that do good things for us, like helping us digest our food and helping us move the food along throughout our colon. And they make vitamins for us. So very important to have a good flora in young babies and infants. The next thing I would recommend is to try to only treat illnesses with antibiotics if you really need the antibiotics. The vast majority of childhood illness is caused by viruses. Viruses don't respond to bacteria. And simple things you can do, like making sure that your baby's getting vitamin D and vitamin C and vitamin A, which is a great antiviral, can actually help with those viral illnesses. And supportive care without introducing antibiotics, which have their own set of side effects, intend to wipe out the good flora is a really good strategy. I also recommend that you have periodic developmental screenings with your doctor or other clinician to make sure that your child is developing appropriately. And if you notice that there is a delay in any of the social markers, for example, like when the baby doesn't smile at about 2 months of age or is not babbling back and forth with you by 6 months of age, not only do I think you need to get early intervention help, but I think it's also really important that you look at the child's medical history and make sure that you are ruling out problems with the immune system, which might be leading to multiple ear infections and therefore multiple antibiotics, or that you make sure that your child's gut is really healthy. So the first year of life is really crucial. Good nutrition, avoiding as many environmental toxins as you can. We know that autism is associated with high levels of lead, high levels of cadmium, air pollution in the environment, as well as multiple vaccines given at once, as well as pesticides. So to live as clean as you can, as organic as you can, and make sure your baby's eating whole foods and doesn't get hooked on either sugar, which is pro-inflammatory, or preservative-laden food, which requires enzymes for digestion that your baby may not have enough to do, because we've never seen these preservatives, you know, hundreds of years ago. Yeah. So those are some initial thoughts.
Those are a great summary of what to do, folks. I want to second and highlight the organic eating. I mean, little babies don't eat much. Do whatever you can to make sure it is truly organic, because the pesticides and herbicides and everything that gets into this commercially produced stuff destroys the gut as well. And when you destroy that gut biome, you're set up for all these problems. I want to ask you one question just to highlight. You said breastfeeding is so important, and I agree. However, so many moms these days are having trouble. It feels and seems to me that there's more tongue tie than ever before, which makes the latch difficult or painful, sometimes not effective. And what tips do you have for those new moms who maybe are having a rough start with the breastfeeding?
Well, I think it's absolutely crucial to get help in the first 24 to 48 hours if you can, because what can happen is that both mom and baby get frustrated if the process isn't working well. We are seeing more procedures for tongue and lip ties. It's part of what we consider to be midline defects, which include things like cleft lip and palate and meningomyelocele. And as you know, Paul, there's some association with a common SNP, a single nucleotide polymorphism called MTHFR. So it's very common in the population. In fact, I have some of those SNPs myself, but the lip and tongue tie can interfere with nursing. And they're a quick either surgical procedure to clip that tongue tie or a laser procedure to clip it. They can make it easier for the child to get their tongue in the proper position. One thing I always think about in children who are having trouble latching on, if they seem to have a weak suck, is that an early sign of a mitochondrial problem? And so we want to keep that in the back of our mind as the child ages, and we might want to do a bit of a workup to see if that's a problem. But by and large, the biggest issue is positioning and latching. And a lactation educator or consultant or a midwife or ideally your pediatrician or your pediatric nurse can help you not let the baby just kind of latch on to the tip of your nipple, because that's not going to bring any milk forward and it's going to be exquisitely painful for the mom. Moms are often sort of shocked because I'll sort of help the baby open their mouth and then I'll like push them onto the breast so that they're taking a lot of the areola into their mouth as well as the nipple. If you don't do that, they're not going to be stimulating the milk ducts. It's going to be uncomfortable for the mom. Baby's going to be frustrated because she's not getting any milk. So don't suffer alone. Reach out early and don't give up too soon, because the baby you know, there's some instinct involved, but in today's current environment with all the environmental pollutants that we're baking our kids in, it just doesn't seem to be easy every time. It almost always works out. The prevalence of primary lactation failure, meaning a mom who really can't breastfeed, is far less than 1% of the population. So you're much more likely to have a fixable problem if you have some problems breastfeeding early on.
Yeah. Don't give up, moms. And partners of moms, you do everything else so that that mom can, you know, feed her, give her plenty of fluids. You don't want her getting dehydrated or hungry, not getting enough calories. On babies, body work, massage can really help relax the. Think about it. You're shoved. First of all, you're cramped in the womb. Then birth is not an easy process for either mom or baby. And babies come out kind of tense. And now you've got to latch on and get going with the feeding. So anything you can do to relax your baby is worth doing. Yes, you can do this. Thank you for that. In closing, are there any, and I didn't warn you I was going to ask you this, so if you don't have one that pops to mind, it's fine, but are there any stories in the news that you've kind of gone, what? I wonder if I've missed any important stories of the last few months.
Well, I am really hyped up about all the news about RSV vaccines for pregnant women. I went to the American Academy of Pediatrics because I hadn't gone for a while, and I thought it was only fair that I hear what they had to say. And I was shocked at how excited they were to advocate this vaccine in pregnancy. One of the concerns I have is that in the original studies, about 1% of the babies in the active vaccine group were delivered prematurely. And that was one of the reasons that they moved the vaccine from giving it earlier in pregnancy, as early as 26 weeks, to waiting until 32 to 36 weeks. But when I did the math, I was just shocked at how we were potentially going to create about 92,000 new prematures. And as you know, Paul, prematurity comes with its own set of problems. And not really have great efficacy in terms of the outcome. For some of the trials, the RSV vaccine didn't even meet the endpoints that they had predetermined that they were going for. And one of the things that's upset me in the last couple of years is that we used to require at least 50% efficacy for vaccines. And now that number seems to be slipping below that 50% mark. So I don't think the uptake for this vaccine has been as great as the manufacturers hoped it would. And we have seen some reports of babies not doing well or even dying after the vaccine, acknowledging that correlation is not always causation. I think that when pregnancy and infants are involved, it is our responsibility as grownups in the room not to take these chances. And to be really, really careful about what we recommend in pregnancy. So I'm on a bit of a campaign to say that, you know, is it really right that we have to treat 82 or 88 moms, which is what the studies are showing, in order to prevent one bad case of RSV? RSV can be managed most of the time. And I think we really have to look at the risk-benefit ratio. I'd be interested to see what your experience was, but we almost never had to hospitalize a baby with RSV in my practice because we gave really good supportive care and we did some of the antiviral things that not everyone does by supporting their nutritional status with A and D and C and making sure that their respiratory status was good, utilizing various types of nebulizers as needed and making sure that the parents knew how to look for the worrisome signs. So the CDC, if you look back for about 10 or 11 years at the average number of RSV deaths in this country, there was a series where it was, quote, only 17 babies. I realize every time a baby dies, it's a horrible thing. But looking at, immunizing nearly 100 women in pregnancy to try to prevent that and potentially causing a lot of premature babies, I think it's a bad decision.
Yeah, no, I agree. in general pediatrics, we saw RSV all the time, of course, every winter, peaking usually in January. And I would have maybe one or two a year out of a, 15,000 active patient practice. I had 30 to 35 newborns a month. So one or two a year ending up in the hospital is not that much. And nobody died. I mean, healthy kids aren't dying from RSV. It was a nuisance. So we were always hoping there could be this wonder vaccine, but I don't think we're there yet. I'm not happy with what I'm reading either. Well, thank you, Dr. Mumper. It is so great to have you on the show. We're going to get you back on here because I know there's a lot more we can talk about.
Thanks, Paul. It's been fun.
You can check out my other show, With the Wind, at doctorsinscience.com. You can also reach me directly, even book a coaching session if you wish, at kidsfirstforever.com, the number 4. Both these links are in the show notes. Thank you for joining us today, and we'll see you next week. I look forward to running together with the wind at our backs, revealing the science that gives clarity in our world that's full of propaganda and misinformation. Visit our website, doctorsinscience.com. Sign up. Donate if you can. Your support makes a difference. And let's make this the weekly show the world has been waiting for. Thanks for watching. I'm Dr. Paul.